Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. Imagine this. Separate the visual fields so the right eye cannot see what the left eye sees. Show a picture of a snow scene to the left eye. Show a picture of a chicken foot to the right eye. The left eye connects with the right brain hemisphere, the right with the left. A special condition pertains to this little scenario. The person looking at these pictures has his corpus callosum, the neurological superhighway that connects brain hemispheres, severed, so his brain hemispheres work independently. Now show this person groups of pictures from which he is to select an object that is related to the picture he sees. He correctly chooses, among a series of objects, a shovel to match the snow scene, and he also correctly matches, among a group of objects, a chicken to correlate with a chicken foot. The left hemisphere has the special capabilities of quantitative concerns in language and speech. Michael Gazzaniga refers to it as the interpreter. The right brain, which Diane Ackerman calls the strong silent one, is concerned more with emotion, intuition, a feeling kind of knowing. When this person is asked why he selected the shovel chosen by the silent right hemisphere, his left brain must speak for the right brain, yet it cannot communicate directly with it. Rather than being befuddled about the shovel, he immediately responds, "Oh, that's simple. The chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed." Herein lays a most fascinating revelation about being human. Our brains come equipped to make up stories. They have the mission to do so in order to explain and justify the world we live in and the actions we take. Note that what the left brain does automatically, instantly, naturally, and seemingly without conflict is to examine the factors at hand: chicken, chicken foot, and shovel. Construct an hypothesis about how these objects may relate. Then, to use a logical argument, chicken is to chicken foot, so the inference is that the shovel must be something to do with chickens, which very logically would be to clean out the chicken shed. One small problem is that there is no chicken shed, and the silent right brain hemisphere accurately selected and thus knows, but cannot tell the left brain, that the shovel matches the snow scene quite distant from a chicken shed. Such behavior may be disturbing on the one hand. If we acknowledge this behavior, we must conclude that our left brains are habitual prevaricators, and perhaps thank God for the moral control that must be exerted by the right brain. But surely the creative, intuitive right brain is otherwise occupied. To contemplate that this brain hemisphere, the one most closely associated with rational thought and language, is built to make up stories raises complicated and frightening questions about those rational, logical, objective processes we so strongly rely on in our studies, our research, and our lives. However, we must find the presence of chicken shit in this story, a source of wonderful humor and delight at our hardwired human brainy being. Human beings are story makers and storytellers. I have on more than one occasion written about what I think is so engaging about the word story. I accepted the invitation to revise my book, Native American Religions, for the sole reason that I wanted to tell several stories. In the epilogue of that book, I wrote, "I particularly like the ambiguity of the word story. It is commonly used to refer to myth, folktale, anecdote, history, as well as out-and-out lie. Often, we never know. It is the never-knowing that I most love. Where's the fun of finding out?" In the epilogue of that book, I recounted, in personal terms, a number of stories related to my studies of Native American religions and my own life history. They were stories about stories, both told and untold. One of those stories was about my father's family. I recount my childhood when I had a wonderful relationship with my grandmother and my adventures as a farm kid. Then I told about my interest in tracing genealogy and that, after my grandmother died, I was given a Bible of hers. Consulting the pages in the Bible that recorded births, marriages, and deaths, I discovered something of interest. Recounting what I found in the Bible, I wrote. Mattie Delphine Fulton, that was my grandmother, was born in the year 1870 in Xenia, Ohio, to Isaac B. Fulton and Ruth Ellen McGregor, and in tiny, fine script beside her name was written, born Susquehanna. My dad always told me that Elizabeth was the descendant of the President Adams family, and that Isaac Fulton was a descendant of Robert Fulton, the inventor of the steamboat. These are his stories, now also mine, and it seems there were other stories left untold. So this is what I had written in that book. Of course, I was referring to the untold story about the inclusion using a fine pen, which indicated that my great-grandmother was born with an Indian name. I think it's funny that no one has ever asked me about this story. I focused on my mother's family in another story I wrote for this epilogue. In this story, I recounted the family history that placed my mother's aunts, when they were children, with their family at the land rush that took place to open the Oklahoma Strip in 1889. After I recalled some of the stories that had been told me about their encounters with some outlaws known as the Dalton Gang, I turned to a ribbon-tied bundle of letters I found putting things in order after my mother's death. These were letters written among the sisters, siblings of my mother's grandmother. The cursive in the letters was written first in one direction on the paper, and then the paper was turned 90 degrees and written the other direction, overlaying the first, a method used when paper was scarce. I tell of reading these letters, and I give some details of one in particular. Here's what I wrote. One letter, dated March 1881, was to Susan Mariah Bales, born 1853, wife of Joseph Avey, from her sister, Sarah. A line from that letter reads, "Joy be to God that O.C. Lenore," that's my mother's mother, "was born healthy and sound into the wilderness you call home. The secret of your Cherokee paramour is safe with me, though O.C.'s features may one day betray you. The hint of a story swallowed by the territory and time." So again, this is what I wrote in that epilogue. Again, no one has ever asked me about this. N. Scott Mamede once wrote that people can endure anything if it is rendered into a story. There is a conjunction between story and science, and between story and belief. The structure of story proceeds from a condition of incongruity or incredulity to the creation of a hypothesis that can render this condition congruous. Then on to recount the evidence to support the conclusion. This is the scientific method: motivating problem, hypothesis, data, argument, conclusion. Belief works pretty much the same way. And curiously, given our distancing of science and religious and other belief systems, as Gazzaniga shows, both tend to focus on supportive information while quickly dismissing conflicting information. Seems as humans, we want to understand the world and are happier with a good story than with being completely objective, disinterested, and technically correct. Where would be the fun in that? While I respect the immense knowledge and experience of Michael Gazzaniga's long career in brain science, there could scarcely be a greater divide between his beliefs and mine regarding what distinguishes human greatness. The conclusion of his chapter titled Selecting for Mind reads this way, and I quote Gazzaniga here, "When the interpreter goes to work on more complex events, the resulting hypotheses and beliefs about the world also seem resistant to change. Even though the similarities are striking," and I think he means here the similarities between hypotheses and beliefs, The quintessential human property of mind, rational processes, can occasionally override our more primitive beliefs. It isn't easy, but when it occurs, it represents our finest achievement. So wrote Michael Gazzaniga. Frankly, I'll put my destiny with the invention of chicken shit. I'll try out my own rational faculties here. It seems to me that rational processes are not engaged until a hypothesis is present. So where do hypotheses come from? Certainly not rational thought. The issue is, how do we think a new thought? Or, put differently, how do we make up a new story? Gazzaniga was interested in showing that from infancy our brains are designed to interpret. He recounted the research done on infants to discern what knowledge and types of awareness are built into being human and those that are not. Since infants cannot answer questions, an infant's knowledge is measured by its reaction as reflected in its facial expression and bodily comportment. Infants have little or no change in expression or bodily comportment for things they expect or know, while they show an expression of surprise for things they do not know. Gazzaniga and others are focused on documenting that infants are preset with some knowledge. What they ignore, but take for granted, is to me the much more interesting thing. And this is that babies have obvious bodily responses to surprises. Yes, surprise is the word Gazzaniga uses to describe it. Charles Sanders Peirce studied hypothetic inference throughout his entire life, and I don't believe that his work has been surpassed or even adequately integrated into how we understand ourselves. We are all taught in science classes about the two standard inferential methods, induction and deduction. These are rational processes, those wonderful high-minded processes Gazzaniga so loves. Peirce, however, noted that neither of these methods increase our knowledge by one whit, and that's his term. Why? Well, he argued that since they are rational processes, they simply move around in different ways what is already known. The real issue for Peirce was how we think something new, and throughout his entire life, he wrote on this topic again and again, usually using the term abduction, sometimes alternatively, he used the term hypothetic inference. The term is to me quite fascinating. Technically, abduction refers to the movement away from the center, but it also means to be caught or captured by something, kidnapped as it were. Peirce argued that abduction differs in kind from induction and deduction in that it is not strictly a consciously used rational process. Rather, the process that gives rise to a hypothesis is initiated by the element of surprise and the subconscious iterative process that is initiated by the visceral experience of being surprised. Hypotheses arise for the purpose of dissipating the emotion of surprise. Abduction, Peirce said, is a feeling kind of knowing. It is the rise of belief, of hypothesis, of the kind of knowing that isn't yet established by conscious rational processes of induction and deduction, by the objective application of data, but it is the kind of knowledge that is most fully felt. Peirce referred to it as a best guess. Diane Ackerman wrote, "We're devotees of the hunch, estimate, and best guess. It is why we constantly ask, why? It is the kind of knowing that can, using other inferential methods, be extended in useful ways to the world around us. It is the knowing that grounds us, drives us, impassions us, and that, because it is felt, experienced in our bodies, is inseparable from emotion, motion, and life. We see on infant faces the birth of this distinctive human trait." So while Gazzaniga is more interested in documenting that infants come prepackaged with certain kinds of knowledge expectations, I am much more impressed that they come prepackaged with abductive capabilities, which even in infancy show that the body is inseparable from the mind, that even infants are capable of feeling surprised, of inventing a little chicken shit where needed. Surprise and the accompanying feeling, kind of knowing, ground our creativity, our stories, our art, our ritual, our myths, our sciences, all these lies that feel like truths. Gazzaniga's longing for that rare human moment when a primitive belief may be bludgeoned to death by that quintessential human property of mind reminds me of those who commonly identify religion with those mountaintop experiences of enlightenment or transcendence. They can await their pinnacle moments for all I care. For my taste, okay, maybe it's one of my many primitive beliefs. Give me a good surprise any old day, a nice crisis, a nasty blow, a crappy response to a lecture from my students. Our innate capacity to invent some chicken shit is our finest achievement. So what does this have to do with our studies of religion and culture? The old notion of homo religiosus is interesting. The term, man the religious, suggests that humans are religious by nature. We are designed as religious beings. This belief has been used and misused by students of religion for some time. The studies of how our brains are wired and what they are designed to do gives us some insight into what it means to be human. It appears clear that human brains are designed to be surprised by what they don't know, and that this condition of surprise is instantly physically reflected throughout our bodies. That the brain body has sensory, motor, and emotional feeling components. Accompanying this capacity, it seems that the human brain body is then built to create stories, which may take the form of fictions, hypotheses, beliefs, guesses, hunches. It appears that we are designed so that our best guesses are more readily confirmed rather than challenged. That we actually feel, that is, have emotions related to these things that threaten or challenge or confirm our theories and beliefs. Our propensities to create stories that diminish our surprises, our confoundments, our incredulities are surely as much at the heart of religion as they are of science. Religion creates and abides by story, myth, beliefs, science by hypotheses, inferential rational processes, and theories. I can't see how we can possibly understand these as separate in any way other than the contexts and contents. If you stand with Gazzaniga, you'll understand religion as limited to those rare and rarefied moments of transcendence, enlightenment, balance, harmony, heaven, order, being centered, goodness, and what comes next, sweetness? If you are with me, you'll see religion as conflict, wonder, struggle, repetitive acts of ritual, dancing, singing, walking, praying, crying, fighting, arguing, storytelling, myth-making, searching. What comes next? Suffering and sacrifice and pain and dying. I also believe that as students of religion, we haven't known much what to do with story, folklore, myth, ritual. What our scientific colleagues are showing us is that our brains are designed to make stories, myths, tales, and many of those arts are understood as lies that tell the truth. Surely we should be comforted on the one hand by this information and energized and inspired on the other to return with new appreciation and interest to these aspects we know are essential to religions and cultures. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.